Good morning, everyone. Just have my introduction stolen. So, yes, my title is about the topic of the transcend direction model. And I'm still slightly jet lagged, so if I say something stupid, it's probably not going to. Okay, so brief plan of what I'm going to talk about. I'll just recall the 6J symbol of the transcend direction model in case you've seen it or forgotten it. I'm going to talk about coherent intertwiners, which we'll use to do the asymptotics. I'll give the asymptotic formula, we'll discuss it for a while, and then talk about flexible polyhedra, which then has a pretty interesting result in this case. So just stop me if there are any questions at any point. So 6J symbol from angular momentum decoupling is given by following SU2 spin network equation, which is a neutral network. Depends on 6R integer spin labels. You've normalized them to find this here, so divide by these labels and so on, just make it a little easier. So, Bonzano and Reggie in the 60s gave an asymptotic formula for this. They related the 6 spin labels here to the geometry of a tetrahedron with edge lengths KAB plus a half. And then they considered what happens when you homogeneously rescale all of these spin labels. So it turns out then that the 6J symbol depends on this tetrahedron. It has a factor, numerical factor, then 1 over the root of the volume of the tetrahedron, these edge lengths. And then in here we have cosine of a subterm. So this is lambda k plus a half. This is the edge length and the dihedral angle of the tetrahedron. And that's the Reggie action for the tetrahedron. So this is one of the original motivations why this is all related to gravity. There's also some additional phase factor here that
counts. So, yeah. Does the volume scale also as lambda?
Yeah. I've left the lambda inside here because it's a tetrahedron with edge length lambda k plus a half. So I can't pull out the inherent factor. So conversion I'm going to talk about the edge field without half, so we can just pull out the factors. But I had to leave that in there because it's going to be some complicated function of lambda, the leading order of which will be lambda cubed.
Okay, that's what I was thinking.
Yeah, so it turns out the half is actually important to get a really good numerical approximation. Anyway, so yeah, this is true for lambda k's infinity, the large spin limit, or equivalently, you can kind of think of that as h bar going to zero, which is when h bar is important. Okay, so. In the same paper, Bonzano and Reggie constructed the Nampel Bonzano Reggie model, which is the first spin foam model for quantum gravity. So the model says take a triangulation of some free manifold with boundary, or without, but in our case, we might consider with boundary. Then you define the partition function, or transition amplitudes, by assigning half integer spin labels to each of the edges of triangulation. You then associate to each of the edges of the triangulation factor dimension of the SG representation label of integer, so it's 2j plus 1 in this case. Then for each tetrahedron, it's 6 half integer spin labels, so you can assign the corresponding 6j symbol to that tetrahedron. So then for each colouring of this, we have an amplitude for each colouring. Then we sum over all the internal spin labels and leave the boundary spin label space. So if you like, you're fixing a metric on the boundary and you're trying to integrate over all the metrics on the interior.
I suppose the psi is missing that, right?
I'm sorry?
The state that is missing in the formula, is that?
So I'm just using my rough notation psi is to denote that the boundary depends on all the boundaries. The state depends on all the boundary spin labels, but you can also have an arbitrary phase on the boundary.
That would appear as some psi of j on the right-hand side, right?
Yeah.
Because right now you just have the partition function.
Oh, okay. I've hidden that, yeah. So yeah, you don't have to use the normalized intertwined ends on the boundaries. Where was I? Okay, so yeah, this is supposed to be a spin code model for 3D gravity. It's supposed to have some quantum gravity, we hope. So it was later on realized that if you write a path integral for some kind of discretized C2BF theory, and then assigning E fields to all the edge lengths and then taking polynomies sort of lattice gauge theory style, when you Fourier transform this using the well, decomposition theorem, you end up with what's separated functions. I mean, this really is just SU2BF theory, path integral, rewritten from where it is. So this is a topological invariant if you do some appropriate regularization. So by that I mean there will be some affinities which you have to take care of in an appropriate way, but that's generally all fine. And this topological invariant is it won't depend on the triangulation of the interior of the three-dimensional, it's only going to depend on the boundary triangulation.
Yeah, I mean, it's not such an obvious point, and it certainly wasn't understood. You know, you can ask why Frege and Fanzano published this in 1968. Quantum gravity wasn't understood to be solved at that time, at least in 2+1 dimensions. And I mean, any naive regularization breaks the topological invariance. It's not at all obvious that this is topological. You know, it's just infinite. That's what people said at the time. It's just infinite. So why is it anything? And you know, it
so I'm going to avoid that point entirely by only considering what John Barrett calls non-target triangulation, whereby non-target model is finite. I won't by handling it. So in the beginning, and divided by this one over, it was the cutoff regularization doesn't always work. Sure, maybe. Yeah. So anyway, I'm going to ignore this. Okay, so yeah, any other questions? So yeah, we'd like to know what the essence of the formula is for the whole model. From this point of view, it's kind of obvious that it's probably going to be taken as well.
Yeah. But we want to know how many terms contribute to this essence of the formula. So the 6J symbol is just a single cosine. We want to see what happens. For bigger triangulations. And I've put one such tree doesn't capture the dynamics in 4 dBF. So
for 3D gravity, we want a flatness, a holonomy perhaps, the identity. That's a force, that is important. But the reason people found it 4 dBF, we also can break the average. But this is very great. Instead of 4 dBF.
Okay, so in order to look at the asymptotics, we want to be able to consider the handle bodies. So my claim in answer to the question of the last slide is we're now looking at this for triangulations of any handle body, rather than just spacing. Okay.
So originally in some rich paper, their model was constructed to agree with a boundary spin network on S2. So they took a planar spin network, associated as dual to the boundary of the sphere, and then they perform you perform angular momentum recoupling, and you do the amplitude you end up with is probably 6J symbols is what's on originally. So that doesn't work with a non-planar spin network. Then the associated is different than S2. So we can generalize this to a handle body of the genus G. So this is my point. I'll draw on the board. So take a handle body. Then the idea is we reduce it to the ball by taking a set of trivializing cuts. You can always do that because that's just what a handle body is. We assume this is triangulated. And cut along some of the triangulation. So then you're going to end up with at the cut. There's going to be one part of the triangulation cut along, and it's going to be identified with the other part of the triangulation cut along. And I'm just trying to draw these lines in the same way. Let's just assume I've done that. So we can we look at the spin network dual to the boundary of this, then we're drawing something in here, a three-bend point, okay, this is the spin network dual to the boundary of ball reduced to. And these are going to be these inherent spin labels for the edge labels of the triangulation. So J1, J2, J3. But now since these J1, J2, J3 are summed over on the interior, and they also have corresponding labels here, J1, J2, J3, what we've in fact got is this one. That's that one, really. J3. And so you can replace this with an appropriate group principle formula, and then it's moving everything onto the boundary. So, for example, this one is going to be it's going to be a generalization of this formula to include more group principles. And so, at each cut, once you pick your triangulation, you can always replace. What's happening in that cut with an appropriate group interval. So that's possibly not very clear from what I just said, so I'll give you an example of that. So to triangulate the solid torus in this way, just doing more explicit example, so given by three tetrahedrons, and your cut is along the triangle K1, K2, and K3. So we've got K1, K3 are identified like that. So you can see that the spin network on the boundary can have three edges crossing these K1, K2, K3 and going all the way around on the other side. The Poisson rigid formula is then given by probably three tetrahedron. There are no internal spin energies here, so there's no sum of the formula. And then, so we can just re-express the whole amplitude as this, where on the K1, 2, and 3 edges, we've introduced a group integral formula. So if you do the group integral, you just get two twice then.
Yeah, so some, I thought I understood, but I don't think you, is one H which comes in all for all three edges, or there's one H for each edge?
It's the same age for all three ages.
Yeah, so maybe he best explained that. That that was the part that you said was unclear and isn't clear.
So what
is the formula you're using to replace the product of the parallel transports on the edges by a loop integral?
Oh, so yeah, okay. I used the my habit notation on the last slide in that. So the age of tensor product of three representations. 3, H, S, J1, J2, 3, J1, J2, J3, normalized into twiners. Yeah, this is, if you integrate these three tensor product representation matrices, it's invariant to act as 2 of these twiners, like this. Seen this one before?
No. I mean, I think I have, but I'm being stupid.
Okay, well, this is, you'd agree, this is issue 2 invariant. Yeah. We've integrated. If you
right, so why did the spins come in twice?
Maybe what he's asking for is, can you represent graphically this integral? So just put equal before that. It's an integral over three insertions of the same
H.
Thank you, Laurent. Thank you. Now I understand.
Yeah. Okay.
Integrated over H.
Okay, so the point is more generically, there would be an edge connecting them, and there would be a sum of representations on the edges, but that happens to be unique.
In this case, it's trivial. There's no label here. But if I add an extra one here.
Okay, thank you. Okay.
Before, I need an extra, say, S. Yeah. But when I decompose that into three
dimensions. Sorry for being done.
Then I can do that for however many edges I have on this. So in this case, there's three and seven ones. But this is just simplifying. Okay, so I can do that for any handle body. I can express it as a spin network evaluation on the boundary, except in this case, we have to put in an extra group interval for each trivializing cut to reduce the handle body to the ball. So this is a torus, so we only have to make one cut, so it's just one group of the color. And written down here, this is a non-planar diagram, so we have at least one crossing in here. It's not a boundary of S2, necessarily. Yes, any more questions about that? Okay, so we want to use the stationary phase approximation to try and find out the asymptotic formula. So, Ponzano and Reggie didn't actually do this in their paper. Somehow they managed to just guess the formula, I don't know. And it was only a bit later, I think Justin Roberts proved this using stationary phase approximation. But, so we want to consider large boundary spins, so rescale k by lambda, see what happens. So, stationary phase approximation says the Hamilton of the following type, integral over sum dx, that could be a larger manifold, sum curve term here, that's an x that doesn't scale, and then exponential of lambda action containing x. So, this is our rescaling parameter lambda. Then it says if this is your formula, then you have to. In this case, we're generalizing stationary phase that's likely to include S being a complex value function, but such a real part of S is zero. So this is very important because it gives us another condition. So the dominating points in the stationary phase formula are going to be these X naught, which are critical points, such that stationary points can be actually as a normal stationary phase, but also such that the real part of S is zero. So this is sort of the maximum. If S is negative, you have an exponential of that, and scale for lambda is just going to get the exponential down. So you need dominant points to be ones which real part is zero. So in that case, you get sum over all the critical points contributing to the formula. I'll start at the other end. You get exponential of the action times lambda at the critical point. You get one over the determinant of Hessian matrix, which is the matrix of second derivatives of action, scales with 2 pi over lambda to the n of 2, where n is the dimension of the integral, and then we have the vector terms here, which are very important evaluating points. So the point of all that is just to say that's what we're doing, and we need to be able to rewrite the amplitude in different ways to do this, just for some data. big spin network, but you don't necessarily know how to do that vegetation phase. So in order to do that, we're going to use called coherent triangles, or coherent intertwiners, introduced by Levine and Speciale years ago. And these have been very useful. It's been quite recently for some of the conventions. So just going to go through this very quickly. SU2 spin K representation is based on calling VK. And a coherent state is sort of the maximum wave state K. So normally KM, which is K. This state has minimal uncertainty, so it's sort of some classical state, and it has maximum projection in the Z direction. So explain that by generalizing it. State KN is just the maximum weight state rotated by some rotation matrix that takes Z into the direction of N. So then this state is going to have maximum projection in the N direction. But that can act on it with the SU2 generator plotted with N, power matrix over 2. Act on that and you get IK, so that's the original state. So yeah, these are SU2 coherent states. If I give you K and some three-dimensional N, you can't completely multiply the state we're talking about. You can multiply this by some state. So if you look at that, you start at the z-axis and you rotate with an SU2 representation into some vector. You can also twist around that vector. That's your phase ambiguity. For every N, you have a U1 for the states that are equivalent. So, okay, there's a pitch missing here. But we use these states to rewrite the normal intertwiners in terms of these coherent states, which are just in here. This. N3. So, well, if you're just given the k's, that's what you can specify your triangles. If you like the n's are these unit vectors, n, r, and they're just done. If you don't really need them, you need to be able to determine the joint, but they're a nice way of doing it. And in four dimensions, it does actually turn out the coherent states are a bit more useful. So, here we're just using coherent states in order to express as an exponential form. So the geometry of a triangle on the boundary, I'll label A, is related to the coherent states. Each edge you take K1 and N1 sign the state K1. Okay, so I'll just mention notation quickly. I'm labeling KAB is going to be two triangles on the boundary of R and the body, label the triangles by AB. KAB is just the edge. AB is just the edge shared by the triangles. So we can use these states to specify coherent intertwiner. So as I said, in fact, just the K's are really going to specify the intertwiner, but in this other basis, the M's as well. So an intertwiner, yokes A, is in the invariant tensor product of these three representation spaces. It's associated with triangle A, so it's triangle A bordering B, C, D. And then it's given by the following formula. So we take tensor product of three coherent states, we act on them with a group element, and integrate over this group element. And that makes variant state, SU2, so it'll be in this space. And so if you like to see these n k states, just kind of different basis to normalization for the same. So, as I said, these aren't uniquely specified by the k things. We need to pick some phase to do that. So, in that query, you can pick any phase one, so we have this twiner. We want to pick a particularly geometrical choice of phase. space on the boundary. And how are we going to do that? So we can always pick our NAB because they're closed up into a triangle. We can always pick them to be orthogonal to some vector, say the Z north pole. I call it north pole, that's what I mean. Then there's always going to exist GAB in U1 subgroup of SU2 that rotates the ends into each other. So this is the N in triangle B adjacent to triangle A, and this is the N in triangle A adjacent to triangle B. So, like this, you have to think of the N U from this triangle. It's different. So there's always going to be this element that rotates them into each other. We can then define the coherent state's boundary using this space choice, such that the NBA state is just the rotating minus NAB state with this. So we call that a Ricci phase choice, because it's in four dimensions this was a very, again, it was a much more important thing to consider. It was just a nice geometrical way of thinking shift boundary or lose that correction.
But is it a constructive choice or just that you know it exists? Can you write down explicitly the phase and or you just know it exists?
We did some examples in what way? I mean, so you can pick any boundary ends you like and you can write that down. And work out the rotation that takes them into each other that still keeps them in the normal plane.
Sorry. Yeah, but that doesn't tell you exactly what is the choice of the phase.
No,
so this is what it, so that's
what it doesn't tell you what the choice of the phase is. So yeah. Now you can pick any phase you like for this one. And in the amplitude, well, so this state is going to appear in the complex time.
Okay.
So then the whole amplitude then won't depend on actually what choice the U1 representative you pick for that state. Because it will then do an e to the I phi for some phase theory and e to the minus I phi for a game. And it won't depend on this. Whether the phase choice is picked. So that's just a nice way of just ignoring all the phase choices in the boundary. So yes, that's what doesn't depend on the phase choice. Okay, so I mean, if this isn't entirely clear, you don't need to worry about it too much, just know that we make some particular phase choice in the boundary, a nice phase choice. Okay, so I can now write the Ponsano-Ricci model in the coherent state basis, as following. So now we have integral over the group elements assigned to each triangle. Remember, in the coherent state, coherent is twine formula, there was a group element, so that's just one of each triangle. And then we're going to have integral over each of the trivializing the group elements coming from the trivializing cut when they reduce the paraboloid to four. So from the torus of the one here. And we can now write this as exponential of the following action. So you just consider the first term at the moment. Sum over all the edges A, B, shared by triangles. 2KAB log of this term. So this is what I was saying, this is your NBA term, and then this same is defined in terms of the state, so the phase is considered between the two. And then we have, there'll be three XAs appearing here somewhere, three different terms, three XBs and so on. This is here, and you find that take three X variables. So these are for all the edges that don't cross one of the trivializing cuts on here. All the edges all around here, all over this. Then on the edges, the spin network edges do cross over this cut, they will end up with this extra group of H. So, okay, that's now exponential of some action. We can rescale these boundary spin labels K to be lambda K, okay? And then we can use stationary phase counts. As I said before, the amplitude is dominated by the critical points. So computation points the action in a real part of f is 0. And it's going to give us the following conditions. We have the gluing condition. So xn hat is just going to be the SO3 element corresponding to the xa element 2. So if you prefer to write it as xa acting triangle on NAB. So this is just saying that there exists some rotations that glue up your H vectors. We have a closed condition, which just says that some of the KAB and NAB is 0. So that's just this picture. So if you pick some boundary ends that didn't close up, then the parameter you can be suppressed. Then the final condition we have is closure on the cuts. So if you like, it's saying that these ends go around here in a certain aperture as well. So the way to interpret this is just saying that each critical point gives you an immersion of the boundary data, KAB, NAB, in R3. So you find the ends of unit vectors, define vector V as KAB, NAB, and you immerse them in R3. And so these are the conditions they're going to have to obey in order to do that. Close up triangles, and we'll glue up. So, I realize that might not have been very well explained. So any questions?
So the third one comes from variation of H?
Yes. Yeah, so this comes from the reality. This comes from varying respect to the X variables in the action.
And geometrically, can you explain? I mean, if you have a triangulation, you know, re-triangulation in R3, why do you need this extra condition? Because you will have the condition that the triangle glue well.
Maybe if I just go on to the next slide or two, might work. If it doesn't explain, then ask me again in a minute. Slide afterwards, yeah. So let's assume, for example, we're trying to lift the ball with two tetrahedra, so more than two. So this is a triangulation, they share some common triangle adapter. Then there are two different possible immersions that will appear in the acid form in that way. So we can have it sigma 1, sigma 2 glued like this, or you can also glue sigma 2 inside. So we're just thinking of these as boundary triangles, really solid tetrahedra in that way. So pop them inside each other. I've labeled P sigma 2 as the parity inverted sigma
2. But it's parity with respect to what? Sigma 1? Or just understand the picture. So you make a parity with respect.
It's to multiplication by minus 1 for matrix.
So, but independently of what sigma 1 is? You mean the global parity, not a local parity?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, if you just think of these, just think of it in terms of, if you don't know the parity, think of it in terms of the stationary points. These are both, they both glue up, mm-hmm. and they're both all closed.
But you're not saying these are the only possible immersions. You can have something else. Okay?
For this boundary data,
for instance, yes.
What are the immersions that you have?
Well, I mean, if I glue, let's say if I glue two tetrahedra, one and two along the face, might be hard to explain without that. Let's say if I glue two triangles,
okay.
That would be along the common edge, one and two, and you're telling me does this triangle and the parity reversed one, right? This gluing and the parity reversed, that would be fine. But there's another option where I take this triangle and I glue the second one instead of gluing it like that, I make a parity transform of the second one with respect to the first one.
Ah, yes.
So I glue it inside.
That's what I mean.
And I flip it inside. So instead of, let's say, gluing these things consistently here, I'm starting to fold them, right? Yeah. So this is a local, that's what I was saying. It's not a global operation here you're doing, it's a local operation. Maybe if you could do some drawing of what you mean here in 2D, that would be easier. Upstairs, grab the one upstairs.
So you can glue it here, or you can glue it like this.
Yeah.
So that's what I was trying to explain in this picture.
Well, it's more like a folding operation than global parity.
Yeah, or in this case, popping the, just moving this vertex over to here, popping the sort of cube. So yes, you're right. And okay, so yeah, so for this case, we've triangulated V3 with two tetrahedra. There are these two possible inertions. You can also do the global parity on both of them, but that's why you end up with a cosine. Amen. So if you just have, if your boundary is just a single tetrahedron, then there's only that one possible inertion and the global parity. So that's why we only get one term appearing in the 6J symbol form. So, yes, that's just what I'm saying. Yeah, the parity related contributions will also contribute. Parity related inertions also contribute. So there are, in fact, going to be four different terms, four different inertions that we have to consider in the essence of the formula.
But only two of them can be thought as really
they're related.
Convex polyhedron. The other one are folding convex polyhedron. Folding on their common face.
Yeah, that's, yeah, okay, so that's why I'm saying emotions of boundary. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, if this is some bigger, more complicated triangulation, you have intersections, you know, all this kind of thing. So. Okay, so suppose we've considered a higher genus body, then this, you get this kind of immersion appearing in here. So we have this cut, which trivializes it, and then you'll end up with this picture.
So do you mind just reminding us of the definition of a Hannibal body?
Hannibal body is literally take a ball and blow a handball.
Okay.
So
there's some statement of free topology that, I mean, it's not true that all free topologies are Hannibal bodies.
You can conclude that they're obtained from Hegel splitting into Hannibal bodies or compact or into manifolds. I don't want to say this because I'll miss out on the bottom.
Okay. Okay. So it's a class of examples.
Yeah. Take that, cut out this, cut out another disk, glue on tube. Yeah. So now that's why I say we always have this cut by definition. So we can't do all of them manifolds, which is a shame, but it's a lot more than the
ones. But you said a single handle, or you can have multiple handles?
As many as you like. Genus N. Glue on N handle. Sorry?
Yeah, there's a sense in which once you give a boundary, this is the simplest manifold. Right. Like if you take a 2D sphere boundary, the ball is the simplest manifold.
And these are three manifolds with boundaries or three manifolds without boundaries?
Three manifolds with boundary, which is the underbody actually refers to the two manifold on the boundary. So I'm thinking of a solid torus rather.
Okay, and what you meant by the thing that Sean said is that you're triangulate in such a way that all of the edges are on the boundary. Or
all the edges of the spin network.
Yes. Of the dual spin network are on the boundary. So therefore there's no sums over internal variables.
All the vertices of the triangulations are on the boundary.
Yeah, so we
there might be internal edges, but all the vertices are in the boundary.
Okay.
And that's just to avoid the talking about regularization, so it makes the demonstration available.
Sorry, what is it here? The limitation of the vertices and size?
Just so I didn't have to talk about the regularization, the addition of stationary point. So, I mean, I can briefly say that as if you've got some internal edge, then you'll be able to take the whole army of group elements around that edge. The stationary phase analysis basically you give you that whole army is flat. It's a sum rather than an integral, so then you have to start considering the sublimit in which the integral becomes sum, which isn't really wanted. People object to do that.
So you're not showing the topological invariance, you're using the topological invariance to say I will only evaluate these special triangulations.
Yes. We didn't use the triangulation independence. We just considered a particular set of triangulations. I mean,
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So in terms of the triangulation, this means that all edges are on the boundary. Is that what you're saying?
No, all edges of the dual spin network.
All edges of the dual spin.
We don't want to end up with. We don't want to worry about these things on the interior because then we have to do this K variation.
But in terms of, he's asking in terms of the triangulation.
Oh yeah, so I was going to mention that. No. So, yeah, no internal vertices is condition. This is non-TARDIS triangulation. So yeah, the example I gave was the torus was just a particularly simple one because I could triangulate it without any interior edges as well. If there are interior edges, then at the cuts you'll end up having to introduce more interference than the labels, so you'll get more interference. Any more questions?
And now you said that the third equation, the additional equation you had, was just saying that these edges close, or what was it?
Just
what is the geometrical meaning?
Saying that this has to close up.
Okay, that's
around this, and so this is where your cut is. These are all the edges on the cut. So you just have to have. So you're immersing for the torus. You're immersing something with a boundary given by these two discs, which I mean the same thing exactly. Oh, this is just saying that there must exist some element that H is. Okay, so all I've said so far is for isolated critical points, but we can also consider when there's a manifold of critical points. So this is going to correspond to what's called a flexible immersion. So I was actually hoping to be able to click on this link. I don't think I'm going to be able to do that. There is, you can construct, it has to be non-convex, but you can construct polyhedra such that you keep all the edge lengths the same, but you can move them. If anyone's interested, I can show you a website. You can actually make one out of paper, which is quite fun, and you can wiggle it around. And so the point being that you can have, you can define a Fanzano region model on these. A good example is given by Stefan's flexible polyhedra, which quite interestingly turns out to have half integer edge lengths. So this is the spin network that's dual to the boundary of Stefan's polyhedra. Topologically it's just ball, but it's extremely complex. And so this is going to have a flexible immersion appearing in its asymptotic formula. So
what is the generic situation?
In what sense?
Well, I mean, suppose you look at more precise question. You look at these sets of polyhedra, and you take away all the ones which have not isolated boundary. Is this the set you're left with, the dense set? So what is the generic situation? If you take a random polyhedra, will it be isolated? You know, or in order to have these flexible things, you really have to find some completely special.
They are measure zero in some sense.
Okay, so they are really not generic at all.
Yeah, except there's a very famous example that has half integer. I mean, this is.
That's what it means, non generic, is that you might be able to tweak it so that it happens, but.
Yeah.
Let's say if this boundary data is average over some other quantity, it will not matter.
Sure. Yeah, okay, so this is more mathematical interest than physical interest. I don't know what this has to do with quantum gravity, but it was a case we couldn't really miss out because it's quite important.
Sorry, go ahead.
I was just wondering, I'm not sure that we're talking about the same thing, but these things have the topology of a torus, but they are pinched somehow. Is that what you mean?
No, this example is just a ball.
It's a ball.
Yeah, just topologically a ball, but it's... So maybe I'm being a bit vague here. This is, I know some shape exists. Is a flexible notion in some boundary literature in R3. So I'm just looking at Stefan's polyhedron and going, right, that's the N I need, that's the K I need, and so on. Mm-hmm. So I've just looked at this shape and then taken all the edge lengths of the triangles and defined the spin network dual to it. That's this. That is the spin network. So I can construct a pass on our edgy model and see what happens.
So now I'm really confused. Is the claim that if your path integral was defined by D metrics, this would correspond to a manifold of critical points, but if your path integral corresponds to sums over areas of dual triangulations, there's only one. So that there's kind of a mismatch between the measures. Dual to this spin network is a triangulation.
Yeah, and all the spin labels correspond to edges.
Oh, I'm sorry. We're 2 plus 1. Okay, good. Even better. Mm-hmm. Okay. So in terms of sums over discrete edge lengths, there's a unique object, but the unique object corresponds to a continuous set of piecewise flat manifolds.
Yes.
Okay. So you need your manifolds?
Say it again, sorry.
Okay. So this is a spin network immersed in S2.
This is just a combinatorial spin network.
Okay, right? This is a combinatorial spin network.
Just a bunch of spin labels and twice and so on.
Sure.
But I put this into the Pontano Ridge formula. I apply the stationary phase, and I say, what's the geometrical interpretation of the stationary points? Right?
Right.
So this has, there may be an isolated stationary point, but I know there is a manifold of stationary points for this.
Right, how could there be a manifold of stationary points if the path integral is a sum over discrete labels?
It's stationary points come from the x variables, the group variables.
So this is not the Ponzano Reggie. So there's not a. That's what I'm asking. There's not a manifold of stationary points in the Ponzano Reggie.
Yeah, but that's why I re-express the Ponzano Reggie model in this form.
The original Ponzano Reggie model is only sums over discrete values of edge lengths. Then there is a bunch of formulas which related to something like a BF theory with continuous integrals over group variables and dual faces.
Okay, so for a polyhedra, you don't have any internal edges.
Right.
It's just
let's back up. If we go to the Ponzano-Reggie model, where the path integral is a sum over discrete edge, I fix a triangulation, I have a discrete sum over edge lengths, and I have the amplitude of the measure term is a product of 6J symbols.
Yes.
Okay. How can there be a manifold of critical points when there's only a discrete set of things that are summed over?
So there isn't even a discrete set of things that's under that. Oh, I see.
You're taking the stationary phase point with respect to the group variables, right? That's the point. Not with respect to spins.
Right, but either they're equivalent or they're not equivalent. If they're completely equivalent, then I can think of it as a sum over representation labels which are discrete. And then
it's not equivalent. Like if you were in the full Ponzano Reggie model, you would. I'm sorry.
I was hoping you were going to answer that. Okay. they're in different variables. But you can write, you can express all of your intertwinements in terms of these group variables and intervals.
Right.
Done.
Okay.
So I mean, it's all completely equivalent. It's just saying how by apply station, how could I apply station phase to the interior jet?
No. So in the original variables, which are a discrete sum, there could not be a continuum. There can be stationary phase solutions, but there can only be a discrete set.
No, but the point of the flexible immersion is that it doesn't change the edge lengths.
No, but it's
Good. So the quantum theory of geometry has different properties depending on which variables it's viewed in. Therefore, they're not equivalent.
Okay.
That is, if you want to see it as sums over spin labels, then it's actually a different theory than when you have re-expressed it as integrals over continuum variables. And particularly, the issue of the immersion doesn't occur in the first formulation at all. The immersion is something which only exists in the second formulation. But the issue of different immersions only exists in the second formulation. So it's something that was added in going from the first formulation to the second formulation.
No, I don't think so. Because Damson and Reggie talk about this in the end of their paper. They say, okay, so what happens when we consider the 9J symbol?
Okay.
They didn't manage to get a weighting for each of the terms. But they do say that, okay, so when we consider the 9J symbol, we'll have this geometric configuration, but we'll also have this one and this one, two or three different configurations. But these are just the immersions in R3 that I'm talking about. So I can't remember how they justify this, but I can look up the paper, and they do say that these different terms will be important when everything's just in terms of the J variables.
Okay, so maybe we should discuss it later.
Maybe you can clarify the question. I think the question of really is that my answer is that you start with something which is the sum of J, and then you replace by this integral. And there, it's equivalent, there's nothing. But then when you take the stationary phase limit, then the question of Lee is in some sense, okay, what happens, suppose you take this stationary phase limit and rewrite it as a sum over geometries inside. And, you know, the stationary phase limit should amount to replace the summation over spins by integrals, right? You understand? You see the question?
That's the only way I know how to do it. We didn't know how to do the asymptotic formula.
No, but physically, when you take the asymptotic limit, you're effectively replacing these internal sums by continuous integrals, and then that explains the fact that you see a continuum, because originally there's no continuum.
Yeah, it's when you take the critical points that you lose the continuum.
Well, maybe we should discuss. I don't want to.
But it's just that imagine you take a Riemann sum and then you look at its asymptotic limit, then you will be replaced by a Riemann integral. So that's what you're doing here.
Yeah. So yeah, let's assume we're all
okay.
Let's
get
to the final.
Okay.
So, yeah. Well, this is maybe also something confusing before when you say. There's a manifold of points, and maybe I think you should explain in which sense. But the thing you get, this triangulation you get, is not a manifold.
No. Yes.
This is one of the very theory. This is the important point. I mean, gravity would be the theory that deals only with manifolds, whereas.
Maybe you can explain
in what sense these manifolds of points do not represent manifolds.
Yeah, so you take the stationary phase variation, and normally you say ds of x is 0 on this critical point. There's no reason why that x has to be a point. That can be a manifold, or it can be not a manifold, it can be a horrible configuration. And it's those points where, that will correspond to the flexible immersions. I'm not saying anything about what you think at the end, it's just critical points. And so then you can, I mean, the action is the same on all of those, at all points on that critical manifold issue. So you can move around this critical manifold, and you'll be considering different immersions of the data in R3, but the action is still the same. Next point. So at these critical points, you can show that the action value is KAB times dihedral angle of the immersion, labeled that by map rank I, sum over all the external edges as before. So I guess there should be a lambda in front of this really critical points. There's no plus half here, so this is slightly different at very low spins to Bolzano Ricci formula. It's actually not quite as good. If you run this numerically, the Bolzano Ricci formula is ridiculously good at agreeing with the 6J symbol. But this is just pretty good. This is good by sort of k equals about 20. Bolzano Ricci formula is good about k equals 2. So this, the half is actually important. You get a really, really good agreement. So, yeah, just a quick note here to say there are some minor signs that turn up all over the place, and rather nicely, in fact, you have to worry about the spin structure on the manifold, but on the angle block, you can choose the spin structure there. Because if you use this, you can use that as
well. But that's the question I was just asking. The triangulation you get, the stationary point, is not generically the triangulation of the underbody. Or you claim it is?
It's a triangulation like that. So no, it's not a triangulation of the underbody because you've chopped it up into a ball.
No, even if you chopped up, what I'm saying is that, imagine I do these two things. I cut a torus, the underbody of the torus, you know, along two lines like that. And then I take these two lines, and so now I have two half donuts. And there's two ways to glue these two half donuts. Either I glue them like that, and I get a underbody, or I start to glue this half donut inside the other one.
Yeah, you don't
get a common body, and this is no longer a underbody.
Yeah, you don't glue it up. So
these two things would be two immersions, you agree with
me? Yeah, we don't get immersions of the underbody, you get. What's the best way to say this? Immersions of like a ball with the discs cut out. So this is like so this is a ball. You cut out two discs, and if you wanted to have one, you'd do that up. Yeah. So we get the immersion of the thing that you haven't glued on the handle yet. So like we get an immersion of this bit.
No, you can get immersions of the folded bit. That's what I'm talking about. Suppose you draw a line there and you fold it back. Can you fold it on top of the other? Now it's flatter.
Yeah,
so this one, so the orientation do not match, you also get that. So it's not a manifold, generically.
But we're not identifying these. I'm not saying they are identified.
No, different. Even that. I'm saying even in an edge which is in the middle. That's what you at some point said, that there's a way that's the discussion about these two triangles there.
Absolutely.
Generically, they are not. Generically, there's no condition that ensures you that you have consistent orientation. What do you mean? Or? I thought that was the point of your discussion there, that if I take two neighboring triangles, then there's two cases. Either this neighboring triangle have, you know, normal which are in the same direction, or they are opposite normal.
Yeah, but so I mean, you take this point here, they're forced to agree kind of all the way around.
What?
That you have to have a consistent orientation going all the way through.
Where does that come from? You have to have consistent edge lengths. Where is the consistent orientation?
The fluid condition? Yeah. Is that what you mean? You have to have them. You have to have these ends gluing up like that.
Mm-hmm.
that they're anti-parallel. If you follow that all the way through triangulation, then you have to get back where you started. I mean, this is... These are the same... This is a different version of the same N. No, that's not true.
But suppose I make a reflection along the common normal of one of the guys. Then, maybe the thing is that maybe the group element is not.
I've missed out the second point. Yeah. There's an additional second point that says XA NAB minus XB H and the A.
Mm-hmm.
Does that help? So this is the group element on the cut. So there's going to be conditions such that this H exists. That maps them in to each other. So that's because this H exists for at least that one, that consistently for all of the edges on here. And if it's going to happen for all of the edges all around the disk on this cutting circle, then the orientation is going to happen.
Maybe we should. My question is the following. You know that when you have a manifold like that with normals determined, then what you can compute, and an SU2 flat structure, then you can compute the Euler characteristic of the boundary. And if this Euler characteristic, which is the number that tells you that all normals are consistently, you know, so even for the same two ends here, you know, I can glue the triangle like that or like that. That's the thing I'm worried about.
But for each of the ends consistently on here?
No, for each of the boundary triangles there, this will correspond to the same, if I give you the same edge length,
it's going to be true for each of them. It's going to be the same group element gluing up each of them. So in that way, unless this has a particular symmetry, then it has to be generic. You can only identify those one.
So can you compute the Euler characteristic of the boundary in that case and show it's 2j minus 2 and not 0, for instance? So it's really a manifold? Okay, maybe we should discuss that.
Okay, so let me just get to the end. The action evaluated on points. The ridge action, as we We kind of expect that. So for the isolated critical points, in large lambda, so I've just rescaled the boundary state in these notations, so lambda, side of lambda is just rescaling all the boundary spin labels. Then we get the following formula, and we get the scaling from the stationary phase. So V is the number of triangles on the boundary or the sequence spin network. C is the number of cuts you've made. So if you have a high genus thing, the scaling is expressed quicker than before. We then get sum over all these, this certain type of immersion that I was talking about. Numerical factor, cosine, radiation, that immersion, and some phase that is generally very hard to determine. You have to take determine S. So yes, it's the cosine comes about from the parity relate, the global parity immersions. They combine into the cosine. Then you're only saying that these immersions aren't related by global parity. Okay, so yeah, that's the asymptotic formula.
Okay. My question is here shows up is that so you have a bunch of immersions, but if you have a Hundle body can not only be immersed, but it can be embedded into our fluid.
Yeah,
so in this sum, there is some configuration that really corresponds to 3D manifold, which is when the immersion is not an immersion, but an embedding. That's what
there will be some embeddings, but...
Yeah, and the manifold, the 3D manifold derives only from embeddings. You would agree with that?
Oh, okay, yeah, but I'm not saying we get immersions of or embeddings of the handle body itself. I'm saying we get versions or embeddings of the handle body once you've changed up the ball, and then you've got these. We're getting immersions of this, not immersions of the handle. And maybe that's easy to say that.
Are all the immersions of the ball of this, are those embeddings of the actual handle body?
I mean, one of my favorite sort of examples is, you know, you can take something here and then maybe have tetrahedron, so you can have a dark. Another valid immersion of that is just pop this tetrahedron inside. I mean, you can pop it inside and end it all over. It doesn't work with this diagram that I've shown, but I mean, assume it's very big. You can pop it inside and then you get to set and stuff like that. But we can't, there's no reason why that should be excluded at this point. So then, yeah, they're not manifest. Okay, so for the non-isolated critical points, the only difference is here. We sum over the flexible immersions, which are labeled F, the rigid action of that flexible immersion. You can just evaluate this at any point on this. Any of these flexible immersions look the same. In this case, the coefficient is really quite constant, so you have to. It's just there's a horrible coefficient. We haven't actually been able to compute one of these explicitly. And so the difference here is going to appear in the scaling. You end up with an additional factor, D in scaling, which is the dimension of the critical manifold. So if you have some polyhedron that conflicts in just one dimension, D is 1. So that will scale 1 power of lambda less.
Less or more? This is going to be lambda. Yeah, so it's going to be lambda to the d.
Oh, sorry, one power more, yeah. So the flexible immersions will dominate. If you have, so for our example, Stefan's polyhedron, we know that has a flexible immersion, but it might have some other immersions that are allowed from that, we want to say. Those will be, the flexible ones will dominate. Yes, large sample.
So the phase AB is the same for all, for when on all the manifold of unpredictable flexibility. You said the action is the same. This complicated phase is also the same.
I can't remember.
Because that's important.
Yes, it is important. I can't remember. I have to check. The action is definitely the same.
You mean a sum or you mean an integral then?
So you have a bunch of completely separate flexible immersions, right? And then you just evaluate at one point on each flexible immersion. You don't integrate over all the points on that simple. But you know, there might be one flexible. Again, so you take Stefan's polyhedron, then glue another tetrahedron on top of it. Then that's one flexible immersion, then pop the tetrahedron inside. That's a completely different flexible immersion.
Yeah, my question was whether you integrate over those parameters.
No, you just evaluate at one point. And the integral gets taken care of inside this horrible factor. I'll just leave that with a question. Will flexibility be an issue in four dimensions? The literature is remarkably unhelpful. Mathematics and flexible dimensions in four dimensions. We'd also expect that we don't have a flat in four dimensions. So literally have nothing to say on that aspect. So I'll just end with a brief slide to say what should we do next with this. We know the conditions under which the radiation evaluates the Einstein action. You have to go a certain type of refinement. So as you refine your boundary, there will be more and more immersions appearing. Lots of different ways to move around the tetrahedron and so on. And so just maybe could this be related to some type of immersions of string matrix?
So what does it mean? What is the manifold, the immersion of manifold this
matrix? There are conditions I think there's an isometric immersion of all in R3, say you have to immerse it in such a way that the metric on LMS2 agrees with the metric in R3 when you immerse it. Yeah.
Okay, so the tangential component of the metric agrees, but then the lapse or the normal component can flip signs or can change.
So it's just an open question. Is there some kind of related in some way to emotions and that form on smooth emotions?
So it's an isometry in the bulk? Just looking for the definition of what is it?
Okay, well, just how can you immerse take S2 with a metric? You can immerse that in R3 in some way.
Oh, I thought you wanted to immerse the ball.
No, just the boundary.
Just the boundary metric.
Just immerse that into R3. And this one question is there some relation? If we can do this refinement, can we relate it?
And you're asking for continuity? Or
continuity
of the metric?
The continuous metric on
S2. On S2.
On S2. If you do this refinement, then you end up with an approximation of a smooth metric.
But with smooth metric, where would you expect that there's different type of emotion? If I take S2 and the metric is continuous, and its determinant never vanish, then I thought that there was just one conformal structure, so you just get S2.
Okay, so that's what I want to understand why. And doing this, it looks like you get lots more immersions here.
What?
If you do it the discrete version, as you refine it, there are more and more different possible immersions that can contribute to the asymptotic form.
Yeah. But how do you understand that?
Exactly. That's my question.
Oh, but that was related to all the questions I was asking in the beginning. That's the, it seems that you have already lots of elements to understand that question, no? But
I think I quite understood what you're asking. So yes, I'm talking there on a possibly badly phrased final question. So, thank you.
Any important question?
Let me ask a sort of viewpoint point of view. So at best we have, if we get the cosine of the Reggie action weighed by various factors and not e to the minus the Reggie action. So to what extent is it not true? That is, if it was e to the minus the Reggie action, there would be a naive argument that the stationary points were solutions of the Einstein equations, which in this case are just flat manifolds. With cosine of the Reggie action, do we lose that? That is that a serious worry that we get cosine of the Reggie action, not e to the minus the Reggie action?
Classic question.
But that's been the question since 1968, so sure. I would hope that we could address it.
There's been some stuff people have done in the last couple of years about choosing a different boundary state. So if you choose a different boundary state, you can end up with just a single e to the I reaction. That's just specifying the extrinsic curvature of that before. Picking the state around a certain extrinsic curvature in the boundary.
Okay.
So their argument, I guess, is that you can't just specify this the metric on the boundary. You need to do that as well in order to really do it properly. So if you apply that here, then I think that's just going to select one of the possible immersions as well. So not only would you kill the cosine, but you also kill the sine over immersions. And you just if you specified this extrinsic curvature and just left with exponential of the Reggie action for the immersion that you've selected in that case.
So that sounds right. I mean, if there is a boundary, is what you're saying equivalent to the final question? Given that there is a boundary, that you are evaluating the path angles on manifolds with boundaries, shouldn't there be a boundary contribution to the action? Since there is, in the continuum, there's a boundary.
This is entirely boundary contribution. This only depends on, that's why we went to all the...
No, but classically the action is the Einstein-Hilbert action plus a term involving the integral of the extrinsic curvature on the boundary. Classically, that's the action.
Yeah, this is the Reggie action, the boundary Reggie action.
Involves both terms.
No, okay, so the Reggie action I get is sum over dihedral angles times the edge. The Reggie action right. of the interior is the sum over the deficit angles. But so if you express this around dihedral angles around the edge, that's what you get. This is the boundary.
Okay, so this agrees or doesn't agree with the classical variational principle where you would have to put on a boundary term in the action in addition to the, that is the Reggie action, unless I'm misunderstanding, the Reggie action is a discretization for piecewise flat manifolds of the Einstein-Hilbert action.
Boundaries.
Of the boundary Einstein-Hilbert action.
Okay, but every time I say S Reggie, S Reggie is the boundary action
okay.
for
okay.
Sorry, this is probably a habit from the literature of everyone says it's the Reggie action, but they mean in the 6J symbol it's the Reggie action, the boundary that it appears. I mean there's nothing on the interior of the single tetrahedron, it's all boundary action.
Okay, I think you're answering my question. But let's we can
yes. I'm interested in the Stephen. So on one hand, you said that the flexible cases could dominate given that flexible spins, choices of spins are kind of measure zero. So how does the two cases go together? You give me a set of boundary data, so K and N's. If that set of boundary data admits a flexible immersion in R3, then that flexible immersion will dominate in the asymptotic formula.
Right. Over what? Because
over the other immersions of the same boundary data that aren't flexible.
Okay.
So if I give you a bunch of K, if I give you a spin network, I have no idea whether it's going to have a flexible immersion or not. It probably can have both, I don't know. I'm just saying the flexible ones will dominate over the other immersions.
Okay.
But I guess this question is, suppose you do, you compute an expectation value here, and any expectation value would take a boundary state where you get summations of a spin. Of your boundary states. So then now you sum over spins.
Oh, so you're peeking around some J's on the boundary. Ah, yeah.
And then,
Oh, then I guess.
Because they are of measure zero, and so, right? And because if they are measure zero, and you get square root of, square root of lambda, it's lambda, I mean, you can just check out whether they will effectively dominate or still be of measure zero. Even the asymptotic formula. So I guess that's the question. Are they still measure zero really when you include the measure?
I need to check up on the exact. Is measure zero in some sense?
Because if they're measure zero in that sense, then they don't dominate.
No, okay. But from all this, I was just saying specified K.
But you see, for physical applications.
Yeah, if you're going to peek it around some set of K's, then. Right.
Okay,
and
then
let's
stop here.
Thanks again.